Hello, and welcome to the Responsive Family Sleep Podcast. I'm your host, Kim Hawley, holistic sleep coach, lactation consultant, peaceful parenting educator, and mom. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by all the conflicting sleep info, frustrated with sleep information that just plain felt wrong, or searched desperately for a truly gentle and responsive sleep approach, then you are in the right place. In each episode, we'll be answering your most pressing baby and toddler sleep questions, busting those sleep myths, and helping you understand truly developmental, biologically normal baby and toddler sleep, plus encouraging you to trust your intuition along the way. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome back to this week's episode. I am so excited. We are going to be talking about all things sensory and sleep with my good friend and colleague, Heather. And I'm going to be honest, I've been wanting to do this episode for forever because I love the sensory info. And while I talk about it a lot, it's definitely out of my wheelhouse of like super expertise. So Heather, I'm so excited to be talking about this with you today.
I'm so excited to be here, Kim. I know this has been a long time coming, and I know we align so much in the approach that we take, and we're going to have some fun talking about sensory today.
I know. All right. So share a little bit about yourself. Heather, just for you all know, is one of my like sleep coach besties. And so she also, we overlap in many, many ways and also have some different professional backgrounds, which is why it's always so much fun to chat sleep together.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I was just saying to my partner that I was going on a podcast today with someone who aligns so well with the same approach I take, except that you're an IBCLC and I'm an OT. So my OT background is what brought in the knowledge that I have on sensory and sensory processing. I've been an OT for 23 years. I'm a mom of three, and I've been a sleep coach for about 6 or 7 years now. I'm out of Ontario, Canada, so I practice as an OT sleep coach in Ontario and managing the parent side of things at the same time. So,
yeah, I didn't realize we've been about sleep coach for about the same amount of time. I don't know why that never clicked for me, but such things. So I love me my OTs, by the way, always. So I love that we can have sleep coaches from so many different other professional backgrounds that bring these different depths of knowledge in, and that we can learn from each other and then also share with all of you parents, that overlapping and differing backgrounds. So let's start off with what are our senses and like what does it have to do with sleep? Because I know, you know, we all think of the five senses, but they're actually more than five senses. Yeah. So let's do a brief, like, what are our sensory systems?
Yeah, well, and those five are the ones that have been drilled into us since elementary school, right? The hearing, seeing, touching, movement. What else am I missing? Taste
as well.
Smell. And those are like the five obvious ones, right? And even then we forget one like today. But there are ones that are a layer deeper that we often forget about that are just as important to understanding the world around us. And they are interoception, which is all the internal feelings that we get about temperature, hunger, using the toilet. If we're lightheaded, that's interoception. It triggers us to lie down or slow down. We have vestibular, which is that inner ear fluid that moves, that lets us know whether we're balanced or falling over. It's part of what lets us know whether we're on our feet or on our head. But we have proprioception as well. And that's the sense of where our body is in space in terms of pressure and what allows us to move in an organized way in space. I always think about vestibular is the ear, so that balance and spinning, but proprioceptive are the joints. So what signal are we sending through the joints to our brain to let us know, are our arms extended or are they flexed? Are we pushing against something or are we pulling? And all of these senses, interoception, proprioception, vestibular, and then all those basic five all pull together to help us learn about the world around us, take in information so that we can figure out what to do with it in our brains so that then we can respond or act in a way that helps us get where we need to go or do what we need to do.
And that's that processing, right, of the sensory information. It's just taking that information in and doing something with it, right?
Yes, yes. It's like multiple channels coming in, and then the processing is what happens in the brain.
So what do we see? What do we smell? What do we taste? What do we hear? What do we feel? On the like basic ones, and then those deeper levels of where our body is in space and attuning. I mean, interception, right? That's also about us being aware that we're tired. That's the interception sense, yes?
Yes. Yeah. When we're tired and we get drawn to lie down or sit down to rest or to lie down and close, let our eyes close. That is part of interoception. And it speaks to the, you know, how easy it is to forget how much these senses help form or inform our behaviors, like what it is that we do.
Yeah. So babies are born with all these senses, but not all of them fully mature. Can you briefly speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. These signals are coming in, right? And they've been coming in even in utero in terms of hearing and movement. But the processing piece is really, really, really immature. It's almost like trying to learn a language. So you get these channels of senses coming in, but we don't know what they mean yet. And we don't know what they mean until we can act on them to see what happens next. If we're hungry and we feed and we feel full, that allows us to learn what that signal means and how to satiate ourselves. If we're injured and we sit down to rest that injury, it's learning that that is actually helping with that sensory channel. What's interesting with a baby's brain, because it's so immature, they're not only learning the language of the senses, but they don't even know how to respond yet. They can't go get a snack. They need to be close to a parent who will provide food, milk, formula. They don't know how to reach their hands towards something or to even turn their head towards a sound. And so this is really a very intuitive process of building on knowledge as the brain matures to refine over time what those signals coming into the brain mean, how to process all of these signals. Like, it's not like there's only one channel coming in. We're having all of these channels send information. Babies that are very young don't know how to take more than one signal at a time. It's often why when we make that shushing sound or we sing a lullaby or we rock our babies, it can go a long way to soothing them because they focus on that one sensory channel coming in. Mm-hmm. It's a calming channel for them. It's reassuring. They may be smelling us because we're holding them, and that allows them to calm down even when there are other sensory signals that are kind of throwing them off, like something that isn't comfortable.
Right, like overstimulating environments, things that are bothering them. I was going to think of a more fancy word for bothering them, but
Well, and I think about feeding, for example. Like, we can, if a baby is hungry, we know the only thing that's really going to satisfy that signal that they're getting, that they're hungry, that they don't even know, you know what words to put to it, what it means, or how to communicate it. We can distract them with movement, but only to a certain point, because that signal is going to be really, really strong. Mm-hmm. And at some point you realize, oh yeah, the thing that works for them is to feed them, so that that signal that they're getting in, that something is not feeling right. Because that's what the senses do for us. They tell us whether we're right in the world. You know, are we doing okay? Are we full? Are we warm enough? Are we, you know, safe enough in our caregiver's arms? All of these things can help us figure out as parents how to change what we're doing to support our babies.
I love that. I love that. So I think that it would be helpful to sort of unpack or dive into a bit, like how do our different sensory systems impact sleep? Like, what does that relationship look like? And I know that's like a huge question. So,
well, it's a fun one to unpack though, too, because we often, you know, when parents come to us looking for support around sleep, they want the sleep piece fixed. Like, what routine, what bedtime environment, all of these things that are very specific to sleep. But because we are very sensory beings, and because those senses are what our brains naturally seek, right? We're almost like little radars looking for the sensory signals from our environment that make us feel safe, make us feel calm, meet our basic needs. And that includes sleep, because as you'd pointed out, sleep is an interoception, the tiredness. Mm-hmm. When we look at sleep through that lens of sensory, at sensory input and sensory processing, it is all about figuring out how do we meet that need to take in information. And I often look at it or describe it as being like a sensory cup that needs to be filled. Mm-hmm. And when it is filled with the things that allow a baby to understand that they are safe and where they are and that their needs are being met, it's like our nervous systems take a sigh of relief, like, okay, all is right in the world. I'm safe, I'm secure, I'm fed, I'm comfortable. I can now relax into sleep, because of course, sleep is a very vulnerable state. We need to feel like our needs are met and that the environment is safe to be able to fall into sleep and let go into sleep. And so when we can look at what are the sensory experiences that our babies need to feel that they are safe enough to let go into sleep.
Yeah.
When we can find what those things are, and we often only think about it at bedtime, but it is the activities throughout the day equally support this. You know, again, if you think of a cup, we don't wait till the end of the day to quench our thirst. We drink water throughout the day. The same with this sensory cup that needs filling. We don't need to just do sensory things that help our baby regulate at bedtime. We can fill that cup throughout the day, and that can help. That can go a long way to a baby feeling regulated and relaxed enough to fall into sleep at bedtime.
I love that. It's like, it's cumulative, right? It adds up what we do at different points throughout the day. And that kind of big picture view, I think, can be tough to wrap your brain around as a parent, because there's so much push or focus on bedtime, which is important, but less of understanding how all those pieces come together, you know, over the course of the day or the whole 24 hours, even when we're thinking about environment and such.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really seems to help parents understand this well is to have them start doing some of the big, like deep pressure, pushing, pulling, heavy work during the day that allows the nervous system to just stay in this more adaptable state, right? We don't wait until a child is in a full meltdown to realize that we could have given them a snack half an mm-hmm. hour ago. We feed them before they get that alarmed. And the same with that heavy, heavy work during the day. If we know that our kids, this is where the curiosity and the experimenting with activities comes yes. in. If we know that our kids are kids that need a lot of heavy work, like they're gross motor kids, they like the big muscle movements. You know, I'm thinking of toddlers in particular, but we can talk about the little ones too, who aren't moving around yet. The toddlers who are seeking, the jumping and pushing and pulling, where we need to figure out how do we give them that heavy, heavy work, that work on their joints to send that proprioceptive signal to their brain that says, ah, I know where my body is and that cup is getting full. Then we can start kind of curating activities or experiences during the day that help fill that cup.
I love that. I want to piece this out a little bit more. This idea that like the big body movement is regulating, but also then there are more like calming, maybe around sleep regulating strategies. So like almost the get the wiggles out kind of play, and then the, you know, more targeted calm things down, even though both strategies are about regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Well, because there's this tendency, and I know you've had clients who have struggled with this too, of thinking that everything around bedtime should be calm.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
And
yes.
No, sleep is a very calm state. Like it's down regulating everything. And yet there are some kids or some periods of development, like some periods of time, where letting off that steam through movement and jumping and rolling and squeezing and horseplay are just what they need to kind of finish off filling up their sensory cup for the night. It also allows them to let off any of that anxiousness or built up you know, tension or frustration from the day. It can really come out through the big muscle movements. At the same time, we know that that input on its own can be calming, even if it's not jumping on the bed or rolling up in blankets or tossing our kids up in the air. It can be things like infant massage, where we're doing a nice, calm, deep touch. So it's not pushing and pulling and jumping. It's a very calm input through their fleshy parts of their arms and legs, their torso, their joints. But we can also remind ourselves that the swinging and the rocking that may work very well for a very young baby can be translated into something for older kiddos as well. That rocking, that hugging and deep pressure that allows the nervous system to just feel safe and calm. It's like that regulation of calmness that can come from that deep pressure that we're giving them. It's more passive. Infant massage is what we do for our babies. The rough housing is something that they're starting to do for themselves. It's why for a lot of kiddos, I always ask parents, like, have you ever had your child on a swing? And is it something that they really enjoy? Because swinging, especially back and forth, you know, you think about that inner ear is letting us know where we are in space. Side to side, we're more likely to fall over. We don't have feet pointing left and right. They're pointing straight. So side to side tends to be more arousing because we're having to do a little more work there to not fall over. Back and forth is the way we walk, we move forward. And so swinging back and forth can be something that is very calming as well. And again, it's passive. It's something that we can do for our babies and for our children to calm them down at night.
I love that. So it's like our big body movement is often push, pull, carry, jump. I don't think you said carry, but it's what I tend to throw in there a lot. And deep pressure, but also our sort of more calming down strategies can involve a lot of rhythmic movement and also deep pressure in different ways.
And it reminds me of something that we didn't touch on, but the different kinds of touch that we can give is processed differently in the brain. And it's why infant massage, when you think about what helps a massage feel calming, it is sinking into the muscles, sinking into the tissue, versus something like tickling, which can feel very pleasant. It can be very playful, but it is the opposite in terms of revving up the nervous system. You get giggles, you get squiggles, you get wiggling around. And so, playing with that during the day can help fill that need for all these sensory experiences that help a baby make sense of the world. But tickling is probably not something that's going to work very well at bedtime.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm like cringing over here with the tickling. I'm like, oh, I hate being tickled. But I mean, there's also that light touch that's not necessarily tickling, but just like light scratching, right? Like I'm going to scratch your back or, you know, like that kind of touch as well. But I want to break it down a little for our, like, I don't know, 0 to 6 to 8 month old babies that are not crawling yet. And then think about our crawling babies and then think about our walking, climbing, running, you know, all over the place, toddlers. So what would be good, like if you're thinking about heavy work and heavy work being that big body kind of proprioceptive play, is there a version of that for like the non-crawlers? Yeah.
Yes, what does that look like? And aside from the carry, because you brought up carrying and that, you know, the snuggling and the deep cuddles always tends to be very calming for the nervous system. But I always think about the movement that our babies are driven to do but can't do yet in the 0 to 6 months, right? It's not that their brains aren't seeking it. It's that they don't know how to meet that yet. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about getting a baby right down on the floor to play and to move them through rocking their body from if they're lying on their back, rolling them gently from one side to the other in a way that they can't do yet, but it's feeding that channel, that sensory channel, or filling up that cup before they're able to do it. When they experience that and they say, oh gosh, that feels good, I enjoy that movement, they're going to be more inclined to figure out, how do I get that? How do I roll over onto my side on my own? And one of the things that I often recommend is lots around moving arms and legs and having them not only, you know, you can picture your baby lying on the floor on their back, and you take one of their feet in one hand and then the opposite hand in the other, and you're lifting them and having them touch together. Mm. And so you have movement. So you have that
cross
that
body
input through the joint, but then you have them touching, and you think, gosh, when their hand and foot touches, and it's probably never touched like that before, that sends a signal to the brain that helps build this map of their body in their brain that's going to help them with movement, with filling their own sensory cup, with being able to move towards or get what it is that they want, including later being able to roll over to get into a comfortable position when they're sleeping.
I love that, like mapping their body. That's so what they're doing, isn't it? Like, not just where am I in space and all that, but like, what am I? You know, like,
I don't know whether you've ever done that stretch where you try to put your hands together and join your hands behind your back.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the first time I did it, my brain didn't have, I was in gymnastics, I think, in elementary school. My brain didn't have a map for what my hands would feel like when they touched behind my back. Like, I just didn't have a sense of that. So it felt so foreign because mm-hmm. I didn't have that map. So the more experiences we get that help map that out, the more regulated our nervous system can be just from knowing where it is that our bodies are and how to move them.
That makes sense. And I mean, wouldn't tummy time and that ability, that practice of like pushing up, that's proprioceptive type play, right? As well, like that,
absolutely.
You know, pushing up on their arms to lift, to look around and that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. And when I hear you talk about it that way, it reminds me of another piece that we tend as parents, especially of babies who are not mobile yet, or those that are on the verge of walking. We forget, and we haven't even talked about it today, about the impact, like the positive impact of gravity on figuring this out. Mm. We tend to lift our babies up against gravity to move them, to get them mobile, when actually having that force of gravity, like their feet into the ground or their chest and elbows when they're on their tummy into the ground, gives them far more information about where their bodies are and how to move against gravity than if we're always lifting up. And so one of the things for babies who are on their tummy, you know, it's not about lifting them up so they can see. It's often about actually bringing more weight to their hips or their bum to feel gravity pulling them down, because that's what they push up off of. If they're up in the air, they're going to feel like they don't know where they are in space. But when mm-hmm. they're given that extra little weight of kind of gravitational pull, putting your hands on them to just ground them like roots of a tree instead of bringing them up like a helium balloon, yeah. The signal that they get from pushing off against gravity is just so much stronger.
I love that. What about baby wearing? Where does that kind of fall? Because that's like a snuggle, deep pressure, but also they still have gravity acting on them in that upright position.
Mm-hmm. And the movement mm-hmm. and your smell and probably your heartbeat too. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about how, you know, I think about my three and how valuable baby wearing was for getting through the witching hour in the evening or those cranky periods of time, not always, but a lot of the time. I always feel like it's where babies feel like they're home, right? Yeah. They have the deep pressure that's calming, and it's not just deep pressure and it's not just gravity. It's you, like it's your body providing that. So they have your warmth too. They have so many of the pieces that help them feel like they're home, like things are right in the world when you're baby wearing.
Absolutely. So floor playtime in different positions is great proprioceptive. And these babies often love rhythmic movement, you know, that swaying, that rocking, that. I think some of the things that we traditionally think of as like calming strategies, right? Like they're kind of more, I don't know, more what we think of when we're like, oh, we're going to calm a baby. We do the little sway or, you know, what have you. That's kind of that rhythmic movement, I think, that a lot of people gravitate towards.
Yeah. And there's actually another way to look at that too, because for a while, I think I had slipped into describing a regulated nervous system as being the same as a calm nervous system. And sometimes it is, but another way to look at it is that a regulated nervous system, one that's getting enough information from the environment around to know where we are, it's about matching the circumstances. And those circumstances mm-hmm. aren't always calm. When a parent walks in the door at the end of the day, a regulated nervous system, that baby's going to light up with smiles and excitement and maybe flailing their arms and legs with excitement.
Yeah.
That's still a regulated nervous system because you're actually matching each other's excitement about reuniting at the end of the day versus being so calm that you're not even responding to a parent coming in the door. And when I look at it that way, I realize that calmness is so important for the sleep piece, but that's just one part of a regulated nervous system. It really is about matching the circumstances. Circumstances at bedtime are calm. We want them to be calm, in a calm state, even if we're using a lot of horseplay to let off that steam. But there are other parts of the day where that regulated nervous system is going to look really different in a good way.
I love that. So once babies, we're gonna walk along in time. Now we have an older baby, right, that is pushing up, is working on crawling, or is actively crawling. What is that rough housing, proprioceptive, heavy work, big body kind of play look like in that phase?
Well, and I think this is where the older a baby gets, the more variation we're gonna see between what babies really appreciate.
Yeah.
There are some kiddos who are very cautious. It's almost like their sensory dials are turned up really loud, so they don't need very much to feel like they're getting a lot. And for kids like that, balancing out that horseplay to be a little less, I'll say less perturbing, less erratic, less unpredictable, a little milder, versus the kiddos whose channels are kind of turned down. So they're not getting as much. They want big, big, like these are the kids that love when you throw them way up in the air. They love when it feels, you know, parents are often feeling, is this too rough? And it's, their channels are turned down. They need more to feed that channel and feel regulated.
And so this is loosely like a more sensory avoidant versus sensory seeking kiddo.
Yes, exactly. And so the sensory avoidant kiddos are going to shy away from some of those big movements. It doesn't mean they're not worthwhile. And it certainly is worthwhile exploring and being curious about what's going to fit best, especially since there are things that happen in the world around us that we need to be able to manage and to be able to process. So experience counts, but every kiddo is going to have their dials set a little bit differently. Those seekers, those kids that are seeking the sensory input, it's almost like their cup is so big, it's insatiable. Mm-hmm. And so they need more of those experiences. And reminding ourselves again that it's not just the one channel, it's not just big movement. It could be sound, or it could be smells or tastes or even textures. We haven't even talked about things like mealtimes with texture, where the broader and bigger the sensory experiences are, the more that cup gets filled.
I love that. Both my kiddos are more on the sensory seeking side of things. One definitely more than the other, but both of them are definitely on that end of the spectrum. So it's always like more.
more.
And so for a crawler, are there any like particular things that you think of that like might be worth trying as far as like some of that big body play? I'm focusing on that because I feel like that's where a lot of parents get stuck, is like, what do I do to help them get those wiggles out? Especially parents whose kiddo might be like in childcare all day. And so they're kind of getting what they get, right? In the sense that, you know, someone else is kind of managing that. And then we have this such a small window of opportunity sometimes for working parents between pick kiddo up from childcare and bedtime. and trying to maximize what they can control in that space as far as the sensory environment.
Yeah, I think one of the basic strategies is to be setting up your space, whether it's the living room or elsewhere, that allows for safe exploration.
Yeah.
So that you're not having to. Yeah, exactly. Because if you have a space where they can move as freely as possible, then you're not having to manage or micromanage how they're exploring and moving their bodies. They have as much freedom as possible under the circumstances.
Yeah.
But I think the other piece that comes up for me when I think about these crawlers is the way to add some of that deep pressure and that movement and joint piece when crawling may, you know, maybe the only thing that they're doing right now, it's their main interest for moving their bodies, but you can still pull in those other channels of proprioception. And there's a wonderful physiotherapist. I don't even know her name, but she has this great video that I share with a lot of clients that shows some of these nice mat based, like right down on the floor, fun activities that have fun names because kids love to have that imaginary play when they're beyond the crawling stage. But they work just as well for the, you know, the 8 to 18 month olds who can really love that hands-on piece as well. So the crawling they're getting on their own, and this is more the you giving it to them. And the piece that I haven't even touched on that I think is equally as important when we're talking about the sensory piece is when we're doing it with them, you have the added benefit of that connection, right?
Yes.
You're smiling together, you're laughing, you're giggling, and that connection is so regulating for the nervous system as well.
Yes, absolutely. So true. Especially thinking about a working parent who maybe hasn't been around their kiddo all day and they're back and we're trying to maximize that time for sensory input and routine and rhythms and all that lovely stuff, but also to reconnect and to connect ahead of sleep separation.
And it can be hard, right? As a parent, say, well, gosh, like, what am I supposed to do? And are they bored? And I'm also thinking about what I'm supposed to make for dinner.
Yes.
And the kitchen is a mess. And yes, I have to coordinate an appointment for tomorrow. And I think when we have these go-to playful games, we don't need to be spending as much time trying to think of what it is that our kids need. And when we find the things our kids love, then we get to do them again. And kids don't get bored of this very easily because they love the repetition. They love the familiarity. You can always incorporate some unpredictability to the movement too, especially if you've got a kid who's very sensory seeking and loves the surprise of movement versus some kids that really love very predictable movement and the game might not have to change very much day to day for them. And so bringing in like the connection, the movement, the routine, like to know that every day this is some way to connect in a meaningful way means less pressure on us to come up with novel things, which, you know, kids do love novelty, but they don't always need it to the extent that we think they do if we can find the things that really connect us and allow them to get the experiences that their bodies are naturally seeking.
We're more likely to get bored than they are.
Yes. Yes. Like, no, you can't really want me to do this again.
Absolutely. And so once kids are walking, then we can start to think more or maybe more traditionally about like that push pull type that, I don't know. I think classic heavy work to me in my brain, maybe it's just the way I was first introduced to it is like push pull, jump, but like carry, not as in they're being carried, but carry as in like, hey, can you help me carry these cans of soup from the grocery bag into the pantry, like having that input of, you know, like carrying something.
Well, and it happens to come at a time where kids love imitating us doing all the household stuff, right? It's like nature has this way of like making it all fold in together. When I think of that heavy work of, you know, carrying things or dragging things, this is the age where they're also pushing the heavy dining room chair across the room to try to climb on it to get onto the counter. So you're working still against gravity, right? But then you have this added piece of the balance that they're balancing as they figure out how to get their body up onto the chair and then their feet planted so they can reach up to all those things that they've been wondering about for such a long time.
Yeah. And I don't know about what you recommend, but I often say it's like the stuff we have around the house that can be the best. Like take a laundry basket, let your kid throw stuff in it and push it up and down the hallway, right? Like simple stuff like that, like an Amazon box, right? Like with some books in it. It's always that kind of stuff, at least that my kids would gravitate towards, rather than it needing to be like a specific toy or something like that. It's like, nah, a laundry basket, a box, like they're so happy just to kind of appropriate household items for sensory play and big body play.
Absolutely. And then, it goes back to, not getting caught down that road of trying to make things novel all the time. My kids, they're 9 and up, and they still find all sorts of ways to use Amazon boxes that come in the door.
Yes.
And it's, it's never about the novelty as much as it is about the actual experience and them figuring it out. I always resort to the example of saying when it's grocery day and you've got that big bag of potatoes, let them, like, you'd be surprised at how heavy a bag of potatoes a kid can drag across the floor at an age where they're also seeking to imitate you and to do the big chores that make them feel really good as well.
Yeah, I love that. I always say, like, also push the stroller, right? When they're out on a walk, like, toddlers always want to push the stroller. And it's like, yeah, let them push the stroller.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sitting in a stroller, it can be nice at times. It's going to be useful. But yeah, that pushing is really, really valuable. And I think that, I always go back to that gravity piece, that all these experiences that a kiddo who's walking and wanting to do that heavy push-pull, there are so many things that we can set up for them, just as you say, with the things that we have. And I always think pulling off the cushions off the couch even. And I, that may be something everybody does, but I still remember occasionally forgetting that, oh yeah, these can come off and we've got this wonderful sensory movement experience of them trying to navigate around these. Or gosh, they would try to lift these big cushions back on the couch and they did not want my help. They wanted to do it. The heavy work of just trying to get these massive cushions, like massive compared to their body size, mm-hmm. back on the couch. And it's just sit back and watch them figure this out and experience all this pushing and pulling and heavy work against gravity. And it's really when we make the environment conducive to that, so safe enough and having something there for them, they at that point in their development are figuring out how to fill that cup themselves.
Yeah, I love that. So it's like you can get in there and do some of these types of sensory play with them, and you can set up an environment and sit back and let them figure it out and have that space, and both are valuable.
Yeah. And I think what's neat when we look at this through a developmental lens, or through a sensory lens rather, is we get to learn what it is that our kids are seeking to have that regulated nervous system, and, to pull it back to what is going to happen at bedtime and working towards, a reasonably calm and relatively smooth bedtime. When our kids know what feels good for their bodies, what kind of sensory experiences they have, or we, when they're very little, are looking at what is it that does calm my baby down or regulate their nervous system, then it's easier to meet it. It's easier to meet the need.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know we've sort of talked about this in pieces, but we were talking a lot about heavy work and big body input and how that's regulating. Thinking about, in that last little bit before bedtime, when we really want to actively facilitate that down regulation, anything we haven't touched on that would be helpful for a parent to think of from that sensory lens of looking at that period of time?
I think whenever I am working with a family and we're trying to figure out what it is that works, I always say, go back to those basic five, right? What is it that, sound wise, visually, smell, touch, and movement help your child? It's almost like putting a menu together in your head of what it is that fills your baby's cup. Often, from an environmental setup of the space, we're looking to wind down the sounds that they're hearing. So turning off the radio and the TV, lowering lights, just lowering some of the input that's coming into their system so they're not trying to process all this stuff that's coming at them. Movement would be one of the last channels you turn down. And it may even be something you ramp right up at the end. You don't know until you try, but, you know, a lot of times one parent will be, you know, absolutely focused on everything being calm and dark and quiet and slow and everything is calm. And the other parent may be more playful and horseplay. And it's like there's this tension between what's going to work best for bedtime. Just try it. Just try to look at movement as something that can really do that last little stretch to the finish line for a regulated nervous system. And I think when parents do that, they really discover what works best for their babies for regulating towards bedtime. The deep pressure, you know, I think there's a lot of pressure on parents to make the ideal bedtime that includes a bath time and massage with the baby oil and, you know, all these things. And the fact is that if you're enjoying it and it's working, do it. But you don't need to have all of these things. It's about figuring out what are the things that your baby benefits from the most. Bath time is one of the things I go back to often because there's, you know, there's this sense that it has to be in every single night because it's part of the bedtime routine. And if we take it out, all will fall apart. And bath can be calming, but we all know babies get really excited with bath time. And I say, take it out of bedtime altogether. Like, do it in the afternoon
when
you're cranky and you're trying to, you know, get through that rough patch in the afternoon. Have the bath time where they're excited and they're happy to be in there and they're getting some of that deep pressure and lots of play. And then you have that piece is not even a part of bedtime.
I say that a lot as well. Like I would say the majority of the families that I support don't find bath time to be helpful as part of their bedtime routine because it's either that playfulness or the transition out of the bath is stressful. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some families, of course, it's wonderful and it's lovely and it's relaxing, but a lot of them were pulling it earlier in the evening. Often right after dinner with those older babies that are super messy with solids just because they are literally covered in food. But, you know, pulling it away so we have time to do more calming things closer to bedtime or to move away from that stressful, you know, transition out of the bath or into the bath. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I love it. It's so much about curiosity, isn't it? Right? Like, that's the thing is there aren't formulas and every baby is so different that I know this is something that's similar in the way that we work with families is that like curiosity and experiment and debrief, right? Like really, really that there isn't one set thing you should be doing, but taking these ideas into seeing how your little one responds.
Yeah, I love that. I think parents can't go wrong if they bring curiosity to it and not to, you know, put blinders on what may or may not work. You know, we always have these expectations around what it should look like. And when we back away and think, just be curious about what's going to happen here, we get to, even if it's a quote unquote failure, like we introduce something that ends up really revving them up when we want them to calm down. We get to take that as a learning experience and then we can shape things from that point on. If we never tried something, we could be missing the thing that ends up really changing our day or changing our bedtime routine with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I say that a lot too, right? We learn stuff from getting it wrong just as much as we learn stuff from getting it right. You know, that's both valuable input and information to take forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh my gosh, I could talk to you forever about sensory stuff. But as we kind of wrap up, is there anything you feel like we haven't touched on as far as thinking about the sensory information and processing and environment when it comes to our littles and sleep?
I'm sure there are things we didn't cover, but nothing is coming to mind right now. I think we covered a good breadth of it.
I think so too. I think so too. But I always like to give folks one last chance if there's something like, you know, we haven't touched on, but I mean, I think we really did, right? Cover so much of that big body work, so much of that calming, rhythmic type movement and bringing that curiosity into figuring out your little one. They're figuring it all out, but we're figuring it all out right along with them, aren't we?
Yeah. And I think that that speaks to the connection piece, that it's, you know, we think about it through sensory, but most of that also overlaps so much with being able to connect, and that connection does so much good as well.
Absolutely. Awesome. All right, Heather, I'm going to put in the show notes, but tell folks where they can find you if they want to connect with more of your work.
They can find me on my website at familysleep.ca or on my Instagram channel of the same name, familysleep.ca.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me and having this conversation. I love talking sleep with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Kim. It's been a real pleasure. It's always fun to talk with you.
Thank you for joining me today. I hope this episode left you feeling more informed, confident, and encouraged on your sleep journey. And just a reminder before you go that nothing in this episode is individualized to your specific sleep situation, nor is it to be taken as medical advice. Take what resonates, ignore what doesn't, and check with your healthcare provider about any medical concerns. Take a moment to subscribe to this podcast so that you'll never miss an episode. And take a moment to rate, review, or share an episode you love on social media. All of that helps parents just like you find me, this podcast, and this gentle and responsive sleep information. I'll see you next time.